This is Scott Richmond
and Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. Arnie, good morning. Today we have some special programming.
As many of our listeners know, John Engen, long-term mayor of Missoula, died on August 15th. And we were lucky enough over the past 6 years or so to have him on our show many times as a guest. And we're going to use the next couple of weeks to share with our listeners again the comments, thoughts, and life of John Engen.
Today is a special edition of What Do You Know, where Arnie and I sit down with Missoula's 50th mayor, John Engen. Serving in that position since 2006, John has spent his whole life in Missoula, where he grew up. Prior to serving as mayor, he was a member of the city council and was also an award-winning writer and editor for The Missoulian. He has owned a number of small businesses and worked for nonprofits. John is also an amateur auctioneer and MC, and as you'll see from our interview, he has a great style of communication. Re-elected in 2017, John Engen has a passion for the people and places in and around Missoula and Western Montana. We're pleased to present Mayor John Engen. Okay, we are here with Mayor John Engen. Good morning, Arnie.
Good morning, Scott, or as I'd like to call you, or as I think about you, John Mayer. That's how I think of Mayor Engen.
Well, apart from looks,
yeah.
Talent, and resources, yeah, I'm that guy.
John, the mayor. So, we're doing an end-of-the-year kind of capitulation of Missoula as we're heading into 2019. What kind of post-mortem, so to speak, for this year would you give the city?
I think we've had a good year as a community. I think we've had successes and setbacks in municipal government. I think we continue to do the kind of planning and the kind of investment that will ensure that Missoula is a great place to live for a long time.
As I was coming over here today, I stopped at my office and talked to a few people and said, I'm going to be speaking to the mayor today. What would you like to ask him? And the same questions are being asked as when we did this last year, ended at the end of the year, about things like snow removal on side streets, leaf cleanup, potholes, anticipating potholes. And we've talked about that before, and that's a common theme, and it's a common theme with any city. But what's our status on those things that really are the irritants for a lot of folks?
So that's retail mayoring, I call it, right? That's our bread and butter. And so a couple of things are afoot. One is we have recently undergone a reorganization of our public works department. Our street superintendent, Brian Hensel, is now deputy public works director for transportation. So he's dealing with all things street. So it's not just mm-hmm. pavement. He's dealing with signals. He's thinking about sidewalks. He's thinking about stormwater and all of those integral parts of our street system. I just met with Brian this morning, and I will tell you that Brian has been unleashed, and that's an inelegant way to suggest that he's been empowered to bring me ideas for how we do these things better. We just had a conversation across the street about the fact that in my experience in local government, we tend to do a lot of the things we do the same way we've always done them because mm-hmm. we were pretty lean, and reinvention takes time and energy that sometimes takes away from matters at hand. And what I've asked Brian to do is think about the work he's done during his career at the city of Missoula and talk to me about ways we can do things better. So today Brian brought me another couple of ideas for snow removal. a couple of opportunities we have to actually. Brian's goal, if we can work through some of the details, is to ensure that that we touch every side street, every residential street within 24 hours of what we call a snow event and what everybody else calls snow. And that's a critical issue for folks. We don't have the staff to do that today, but Brian thinks he can come up with a program and resources to help us do it. It's going to cost us more money, but we think the investment will be worth it, and we think the investment will be relatively low based on our return. So,
and it is challenging, you know, for a small community, because weather, even in 2019, is writing into it, is still an imprecise science. You know, we're recording this on Thursday. Last night, there was going to be 4 or 6 inches of snow in Missoula. We needed, as a city, to prepare for that, right? And, of course, it didn't happen.
Right.
And so you have, you know, a disconnect often between what might be a snow event or a weather event and the need to respond to it.
Well, what we do, however, is so our teams are interdisciplinary, right? So if I've got a plow operator who has nothing to plow, those folks are looking at other infrastructure and making repairs. Brian quoted me a number for potholes this calendar year that was north of 7,000 potholes filled. So we, you know, if it ain't snowing, we got other work for folks to do, which is, you know, beautiful. But when we're plowing, we're not filling potholes. So, right, that's the trade-off there. And you're right, we are incredibly weather sensitive in that department. And I will tell you, as mayor of the city of Missoula, I don't like snow. I'm done with it.
Or ice, right. Which is even a worse problem.
Right. I also have no control over that. What I have some control over is how we respond to it. And so Brian and his crew are going to cook up some new ideas for us, and we're going to test drive them.
How do other cities in western Montana, like Kalispell, handle things like this?
One of Brian's charges. I want to understand best practices from other jurisdictions, right. Not just in Montana, but I'd like us to compare climates, cities with similar climates, and understand what they're doing and how they're responding to snow. There's technology that some communities use. They use what are called they use gates on plows. So when you get in front of a driveway, for example, you don't dump a berm. You're actually clearing that path. Right. You're lifting and dropping. It takes more time. It's a little more labor intensive, but you get a different product as you plow. And that, you know, that stuff is deployed all over the place. And again, to a certain degree, just as a function of capacity and time and prodding, we've done things the same way we've done them for a long time. So I'm really excited about some of the innovation that I'm going to see from his group.
Well, particularly with, you know, climate change, you're just seeing much more unexpected weather phenomena. I mean, you don't see the bridges in New York freezing in November,
right.
And jamming the whole city up. I mean, that is not in our whole life. You don't see that. I can't remember 2 or 3 times when that happened.
Right.
But we could tomorrow. We could have a 1996 snowfall, and we would be going 24/7, and it would still be a mess. And you know, we're doing our best to meet expectations, to learn and grow, and as always, balance that with the amount of money that we can collect from folks who are paying the bills.
Talk about money for a second.
Yeah.
The other thing that you hear echoing around the community is the increased property taxes.
Yep.
I don't live in the city. I'm in the county, but I'm paying a lot more property tax than I paid 2 or 3 years
right.
ago. What's your sense of why that's happening, and where's it going in the next couple of years?
So, and we spent a lot of time on the property tax issue. Probably 9 months ago, I assembled a group of both commercial and residential property owners. They formed what's called the Property Tax Working Group. And we've been studying property taxes. We've been studying taxation statewide. We've had folks as varied as Mike Katus, who's now the retired director of the Department of Revenue, the guy who collects taxes for the state. We've had legislators. We've had retired city managers from jurisdictions where the local option sales tax is in play. And we've heard a lot from the folks who are sitting at the table with us. And these are, I selected the folks who are serving on this group not because I wanted them to make me feel better about property taxes, because I wanted to know what they were thinking and what they were experiencing. So we've got, we have a developer who's seen taxes double and on various properties, and in some cases on undeveloped properties he's seeing those taxes double. There are a couple of causes. Really the primary cause of late, and what created a bunch of community sticker shock over the last couple of years, was the reappraisal. So the state has gone from a six-year appraisal cycle to a two-year appraisal cycle. So some properties were not appraised for 6 years, or depending on where they were in the cycle, for almost 8 years. And as we all know, values have changed over the course of 8 years. And it's one thing to see those values on an incremental basis year over year, but when you don't do that appraisal for 6 years, it's a big change. Mm. And a lot of people saw a big change as a function of this two-year appraisal cycle. So many of those people, in fact, saw that change that a proportion that we're not used to went back to the Department of Revenue and said, wait a minute, I think this number is too high. And in many cases, either the state or the Tax Appeal Board said you're right and backed off that value. Value backs off, that means taxable value decreases. And that means we collect less money. So as a function of our budget cycle, we were predicting a number that was X, and we ended up with a number that was X minus, about $1.2 million. And that's a big deal in a budget like ours. We think, and what we're hearing from the state is that the two-year cycle will now sort of temper, right? We're not anticipating a spike like we saw. And what one large commercial property owner suggested to me was, I have some expectation of 2 or 3% a year, and I can manage my business based on that, but I can't manage my business based on 12 or 20 right. or 30 or 40%.
Yeah. That keeps happening. They're going to call you.
It's us,
right?
That keeps happening. They're going to call you the sheriff of Nottingham,
right? So my sense is those things are going to even out. And despite the fact that I have a reputation for controlling many things,
you don't control that.
Among the things I don't control is those property values. The good news is property values are going up. The bad news is you don't realize that value until you sell. So if you're using your property and intend to use your property for a long time, you're not realizing that increase in value.
And you're also seeing it on the buy side too, because property is going up and up and up here.
Right, right.
What do you think you could do to communicate to people in Missoula about this? Right, because the biggest challenge is that when there's no communication, or when they see it as being, a lack of communication, they're like, they just keep on echoing the same claims.
It's enormously challenging to communicate this stuff. For one thing, it is not sexy. And frankly, a lot of people don't care until there is an event that triggers a bottom line issue, right? Mm-hmm. The minute it hits my pocketbook, I really want to have some answers.
Right.
And the system is complex. We are but one of a number of taxing jurisdictions. and our expenses continue to increase. But the challenge for me, and I think the opportunity for me and for us as a community, is where is the new revenue? What boat are we missing? And I will tell you again and again that I think the boat we're missing, not only as a city but as a state, is getting tourists to pay their fair share.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Probably less than their fair share, but even less than their fair share would go a long way to help.
More
us.
Than their unfair share that
correct.
They're paying
correct.
Correctly.
Right. You know, if we were enabled by the legislature to institute a tourism tax, I believe that we would be able to reduce property taxes. Moreover, I would guarantee, as a function of putting that tax before voters, that there would be property tax relief built into it.
Now, we've talked about this before, and I've always
yep.
said, as you travel around, you check into a hotel and almost anywhere in the country,
yep.
and you see a tax of 10, 12, 14, sometimes in New York City it could be $30.
Yep.
We're not in New York City, a night, and you pay it. You
right.
just factor it in. The room's $104 and the tax $17, so you're paying
right.
you know, $121 a night. It doesn't seem to be a painful thing to do. What is the opposition to that?
The opposition really comes at the state level. And it is, I think it's as simple as this. If you're a legislator representing a small community or unincorporated residents anywhere in Montana who have to go to Missoula or Helena or Butte or Billings or Bozeman or Livingston or Kalispell, or you name the community, to go to Costco or Walmart or
right
any of those places, they say they don't get anything out of paying that tax. They're just enriching this community. And
why don't exempt Montana residents from it?
Well, that's certainly an option. But if you're a legislator from one of those areas, ain't no way you're going to try to sell that to your constituents, because they're having none of it. So, and the way the legislature is constructed, there's disproportionate
sure.
representation among rural communities.
But even if it's limited to a bed tax, they have that same.
Well, the bed tax exists.
Yeah, it already exists.
Right, but it's not high enough.
Well, and it only supports,
there are others that would argue that it's high.
So it only supports tourism marketing.
Right.
Right. And some state general fund.
Right, but that could be adjusted.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it is a heavy lift. I do not anticipate the Montana legislature supporting a local option tax for communities of our size. We're going to trot out a bill anyway. My suggestion, and this is the boat we're floating, is I would like the legislature to consider an initiative, and if the legislature isn't interested in that, I'd like a citizen initiative to ask voters across the state whether they would support a 3% tourist tax that would go to reduce property taxes, and let local jurisdictions vote on that. My hunch is that if I had somebody hunkered out of outside Fresh Market with a clipboard saying, would you support a 3% tourist tax to reduce property taxes, we could get enough signatures to get that on the ballot.
You just have to say reduce property taxes. They won't read the top part. They'll just sign
right.
it.
And I mean, this is... I mean, in a perfect world, which ain't the place we live in, we would have a tax system that wouldn't require cities to raise money through property taxes or to chase some of these additional revenues, but we have a far from perfect tax system. So a sales tax, while regressive in nature, can be adjusted to minimize that regressive nature, and property tax is pretty darn regressive too. So,
mm-hmm.
So in this imperfect world, how do we find some good pieces that we can pluck? And there is new revenue. How many people visit this state a year?
Mm.
Millions and millions. About 3 million visit Missoula. You know, a Pearl Jam concert is a wonderful thing, but it costs us money.
Right. Missoulians don't. It's funny. Missoulians don't think about tourism, right? In their backyard, they don't understand the impact. They really don't. It's an education thing, and it.
And there's value there.
Sure, but they don't. I just don't think people consider that this is a destination when they compare themselves with Big Sky and Bozeman and it's becoming, Kalispell and
Whitefish. And it's becoming more of a destination for all sorts of reasons.
Right, it is.
Not the least of which, it's cool.
Music.
You add music to that mix. You add events at the university. You add a vibrant downtown. You add a shopping district. You add outdoor recreation. And we have a place here. And this place is a place where people want to be and visit and spend money.
Agreed.
You bring in one entrepreneur like Nick Chakota,
right?
And he creates this demand for
there is an ecosystem of music here that did not exist,
and drawing people from other
five
places
years ago.
Here.
Absolutely, and what Nick's done is phenomenal.
Well, you've got it there, right? But we've spoken to a lot of those folks on our show. We spoke to Andy Holleran, the Merc. We've spoken to Drake Depke over at Sakatimi. I mean, these are people coming into the market that want to see a huge opportunity here in that space.
The story of 2018. Is we're discovered and investors are bullish on our place, and they're bullish for a reason, right? These aren't naive people. Folks who seize opportunities and right. are gonna come in here, sell their wares, slam the trunk, and move to the next town. These are people who are willing to invest and participate in the community because they believe in it.
You know, I can tell you that it resonates around the country. People are shocked that we have in this community raised for the old Sawmill District project, $24 million in foreign investment into Missoula, Montana.
Right.
Some people can't get that in Savannah, Georgia, or much bigger, metropolitan areas. And we were able to do that here because we have a good story to tell, and there are good entrepreneurs here. Let me talk about. You said there were highs and lows. Let me talk about one of the lows that we're trying to deal with, which is the decreased enrollment at the University of Montana. That has a tremendous ripple effect. If you have 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 less students here than you did 4 or 5 years ago, those are, in some people's minds, those are just consumers that have left the community that were spending a lot of money here. Mm-hmm. What does the city see as its role in trying to facilitate a resurgence at the university?
So to a certain degree, my job is to meddle. That work is made much simpler when someone is receptive to the meddling, and Seth Bodner is receptive. Seth and I meet regularly. I meet with his staff regularly, and we're working closely on not only some planning efforts, expanding campus, really, and looking at the University of Montana not as a place with boundaries, but as an opportunity for town and gown to work together. So we're talking about this innovation corridor where we plan together, we invest together, and we succeed together. We're having conversations around how do we better use the remarkably talented faculty, staff, and students of the University of Montana to move the community forward. We at the City of Missoula contract with consultants all day long to help us get work done that we don't have capacity to do in-house. There's a ton of expertise at the university, and we're working on creating an arrangement whereby we can
tap into that.
Really contract with the University of Montana to get that work done. Students have a experiential learning opportunity. They're also talented and smart. They're thinking of things that we don't think of. They get paid, which helps a lot. We have faculty members who are serving as the project managers. They bring expertise. They also get experience sort of outside of the academic realm that doesn't cost them. They don't need to go anywhere for that experience.
Have we put a finger on what happened Is there a general consensus on what drove enrollment down? Because I have an opinion about that myself. That's not analytical, but
I can only speak for myself. I think that in crisis, the University of Montana found itself not taking care of fundamental stuff. You got to answer a student's email when they inquire about going to school at your university. You have to be responsive to people, your customer base. You have to acknowledge them, and you have to attract them as customers. And in crisis mode, investment in recruitment, investment in enrollment, investment in those basic services, I think went by the wayside. Seth, Kathy Cole, and his team are working to rebuild that. And some of it's as fundamental as having the right software to ensure that that you're managing those relationships with prospective students. Part of it is systemic. You have to, as I hope we do here at the City of Missoula, build a culture wherein I'm in the business of serving my community, and if you want to have a meeting with me, you're going to have a meeting with me. I may not be able to help you, but I'm going to acknowledge your pain, and I'm going to do my damnedest. We need to do that for students as well. Students need to feel embraced and wanted and appreciated and respected, and that takes time and money, and it takes a shift in culture. And when you're running 14,000 strong, there is a chance that you're going to start taking your student body for granted, and you're going to behave in ways that it's nothing nefarious. It's human nature, right?
Yep.
And so when it's easy, you act easy, and when it gets hard, you can't act easy.
I think you also can't discount the social media effect of the book.
I don't think you can discount any of that. I mean, there became a narrative around a university in crisis, and when that is the only narrative, it's really hard to sell your product.
Yeah.
I can tell you the University of Montana ain't the Titanic, and there's no iceberg waiting.
No.
What the opportunity here is huge. This university has a ton to offer, and I think Seth and others are recognizing that not only as an institution do they have much to offer, but they happen to be in a community where people want to be. You combine those two things and you tell that story, it's pretty damn powerful.
And we talked about this before, but the Montana State is doing an exceptional job with their contact management and their marketing.
Right.
To your point.
Right.
So we have there's a lot of competition.
Yep.
And they've got to up their game here to compete with them.
But in fairness, and I'm not always fair when I think about this, but in fairness, they offer a different curriculum over there, and they're still seeing some of the benefits of all the oil field activity for their engineering school and for some of those other sorts of things that they and their ag business, and that has those things ebb and flow.
We have devalued what we teach at the University of Montana,
right.
And we should not devalue
exactly.
it.
Right.
Fritz Landman at ClassPass will tell you all day long that he's not hiring engineers from Bozeman. He's hiring liberal arts graduates from the University
That's
of Montana
right.
because they can think, they can have conversations with real human beings. They're creative, they adapt,
sure.
and they want to do
critical
good
thinking.
Things.
Tom Sturgis, of his 130
Absolutely.
Employees, 100 are UM graduates.
And right. Arnie, the one thing is, my son's a senior. He is applying to schools right now. They're beating down his doors from Montana State. I haven't seen much paperwork come from U of M.
And that totally needs to change. And Kathy, I think, is all over that. Unfortunately, like all of our institutions, we don't turn on a dime. And
right.
And I think what Seth and his team And UM supporters in the community are interested in doing is giving them as much help as we can in helping in allowing them to be agile. And there's a finite window here, right? In terms of there are things that need to be turned around, and I don't think there's anyone more aware of that than Seth Bott.
Right, exactly.
And that sense of urgency is what will ensure that this institution is restored to its glory.
Sure. You know, it's an interesting sidebar to all of this, and I wanted you to speak to you from your journalistic background. It used to be newspapers were very influential.
Yeah.
And in some places they still might be, even with all the mantra of fake news, and et cetera. But social media sets the agenda now. You know, I didn't know anything about problems with, you know, sidewalks in Missoula until, you know, I go on a social media, portal, and there's all these stories about it. And the headlines kind of set for a lot of people what the issue is,
yep,
whether it's substantive or not. How do you interface? How do you, do you pay a lot of attention to that? Do you try to engage with that and interface with it to help set that tone? Because once that's out there, then you're all in a defensive mode trying to refute what may not in fact be true at all.
Right. And I think therein is the problem, Arnie. So I visited Google. I Googled, how do I get rid of my Facebook account? Because I didn't happen to have a young person in immediate proximity to tell me how. And I deleted my Facebook account. I rarely used it. I may have posted a few things over the years, had one for the campaign. I got rid of both of them. In part, as a minuscule and likely meaningless protest over the use of folks' data for, I think, nefarious purposes. But at the end of the day, if I spent any time on Facebook, I would be distracted all day, and I would be working on extinguishing fires that did not exist. I would rather spend my time acknowledging real world conversations and the facts as I know them, and manage accordingly. And I think the long arc, Facebook is this tiny slice of time that something flares and then it subsides. It's a tiny tide, and it goes in and out relentlessly.
What's so funny is I talk to my nieces and nephews who are in their 20s, and I talk about Facebook, and they said, "We don't even use Facebook. They're all into Snapchat and Instagram and these other sources." It's almost like, you wipe out one infestation, and then there's this other social media infestation.
There's going to be another thing. What I will tell you is that I have an Apple News feed, and most of what I'm paying attention to is New York Times and Washington Post, and I have a Twitter account, and I follow who I follow. The fact of the matter is, though, that I know that Twitter account is giving me a picture that's skewed to my interests and my biases, right? And so I can put no more stock in that than I can in lots of other sources.
I see that as the challenge of social media. When you used to get a newspaper every day, I would read it from cover to cover, and you would read things that weren't programmed for you to read.
The fundamental principle that I learned in journalism school was fairness.
Right.
That is not impartiality.
Right. Right.
It's not. But it is fairness. Right. And I learned news judgment. Right. So in this finite space, on this 24-hour cycle, based on what I know about my community, my education, the trained people around me, what's most important for me to tell the people tomorrow.
Well, what's interesting about that, and you're a trained journalist, you learn this, you know where you can get fair, you know, information. It really has changed from just even a couple of presidencies ago, putting aside personal politics and all of that, from having, you know, John Kennedy or, you know, Richard Nixon or, you know, any of the presidents from either party, you would get their understanding of policy from their team. You would, you know, Secretary of State, or they would do it when they did a press conference once a month, or, you know, not very often, when they did the State of the Union address. We now have a centralized tweet system that is every single morning there's 5, 6, 7 tweets from the president, and it captures, you know, the news cycle every single day. And that's such a huge change from the way a thoughtful, laid out, strategic kind of way of doing things. What do you see as the effect of this?
Well, so for me, the effect is that we stop. We don't pay attention to the long game, right? The long arc, I believe, is the way Martin Luther King described it, right? Everything is a slice, and we react and adjust to the slice. I am glad no one can read my mind, because I there are a lot of iterations that come into play before I decide where to have lunch, let alone how I decide whether or not we're going to move forward with a sidewalk project. The decision-making process, the public process, takes time, and if we just slice little bits of that process apart, it looks ridiculous, it looks confused, and it doesn't make a great deal of sense. Taken as a whole, you can start to see the larger picture. So you know, whether it's any president who were to type whatever is on his or her mind at any given moment all day long would probably not present particularly well. There may be some exceptions to that, but this impetuousness and our impatience and this notion that there needs to be a scoop, and we need to understand every turn of the screw.
Well, it drives advertising.
Right.
It drives. The interesting thing, Arnie, we're just looking at is Missoula. Facebook is with the Rockefeller Foundation is giving $1 million to a local nonprofit here in Missoula. Okay, so the thing about Facebook or Instagram, all these things, it's how you use the medium. In many ways, it's how you program to the medium and publish to the medium.
Yeah, but it does impact in a different way than ever before. You never had a president of the United States go on a rampage against, like, John Tester,
right?
You know, on a daily basis, and not only on a rampage,
but
call him liar, John, and all this kind of stuff. It's just unprecedented on how to.
He's unprecedented on every level, though, like his message and his medium, right. And that's where he's used Twitter so effectively. The thing is, this is that he uses it well, right? Because otherwise, it's like everyone's waiting for that buzz in their pocket at 5 a.m. because it's 7 a.m. when he does it, or 3 a.m. to see what he's going to say, but he dictates the
agenda. He does suck all the air out of the room. But
yeah.
But the point for me in talking with John is you're a mayor. You're mayor of a city. You know, the president shows up here. He attacks local people. He leaves. He continues to do things that affect Missoula, Montana directly. How do you, you know, deal with that?
I continue to show up. Ooh. Every morning with my mantra, what am I going to do to make somebody's life better today? And sometimes that's a big, long deal. Sometimes it's a matter of hearing somebody out on an issue that's completely personal to them and I can't affect. The interesting thing, for better or worse, is that all of that noise has very little effect on the way I do business here in Missoula, Montana, and the way we do business here in Missoula, Montana.
What has changed since you took office at the beginning of how you do business?
What has changed?
Yeah.
Well, social media has certainly changed. Has changed our work because we do end up on occasion something rises to the level that's beyond distraction, and you got to deal with it, right? And that it takes time and resources to deal with that stuff. In some ways, there's more communication. In some ways, some people are more engaged, and that's great. There's an upside to all of this as well, and that is, I think more people are paying attention to local government. More people are aware of goings on because of these social relationships mm-hmm. and this interface on the
sure.
screen.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
What has changed in terms of the way we do business is that social media hasn't changed much of that. What has changed is my understanding of how much time it takes to get things done, when to be patient, when to be impatient, when to be ahead of the folks I serve and when to follow them a little bit. It turns out experience matters in this work. I'm a much different mayor than I was when I took office in 2006. I have more patience for some things and less for others. But it's always different. It's always interesting, and there are always opportunities for us to do better. The silver lining of sending somebody a notice that they're going to pay $40,000 for a sidewalk is that once I apologize to them for causing them pain and stress, is that I now am acutely aware that we have an opportunity to do this one thing better.
And for our listeners, why don't you explain the sidewalk issue?
Sure. So since time immemorial, as the city has built its sidewalk network, we've relied in no small part on adjacent property owners to help pay the freight. And this latest project, and we've been doing these projects for years, I've been a part of them as both a council member and certainly as mayor. We propose these sidewalk projects. They're based on a master plan. That master plan gets implemented in stages. This particular stage, in our Slant Street neighborhood, the combination of the size of lots and the bidding environment and the cost of materials and labor has taken these projects where I could count on an adjacent property owner to agree sometimes grudgingly and sometimes very willingly to make an investment of a few thousand dollars to complete this infrastructure or repair it, right, for the public good and to the benefit of their property. We've gotten beyond asking folks to help us in those numbers to $40,000 in one case on a corner lot for a couple who are both on Social Security and work part-time. And it's an opportunity for me to say, look, we've done this way forever. I don't think it's going to work anymore. and so let's figure it out. And today, you know, we had council members, I think, asking excellent questions about the program and how we ought to move forward, and we had citizens coming to us expressing, you know, certainly dismay at the fact that, you know, this bill lands in their mailbox with a thud, but also giving us really thoughtful responses and asking really thoughtful, critical questions about how we move forward. And I think we can take all that, and I think at the end of the day, we're going to come up with something way better.
Good. We're heading into 2019. What are the headlines of your agenda for the city of Missoula for this next year?
City of Missoula and University of Montana celebrate turnaround in enrollment. City of Missoula and University of Montana announce joint planning on campus and Broadway corridor. City of Missoula improves service in public safety through police and through police response. City of Missoula continues to work with agencies to address those fundamental issues of homelessness, of hunger, of addiction, and of folks in mental health crisis.
I mean, it is a watershed to me, a point in history where you have to be discussing warming shelters in a city like Missoula, Montana. I mean, how as a mayor do you deal with, I mean, you just mentioned, you know, the addiction issues and the homelessness issues and how that as an anchor on a community is so, you know, weighty for us to deal with that.
Well, maybe I'll step back and amend my previous answer with regard to what has changed over the course of my tenure. One of those things is that the federal government has continued to abdicate its responsibility with regard to taking care of people in basic ways, and we're left to fill those holes. And we are traditionally not well equipped to fill them. So we're making adjustments in the way we do business, either through partnerships with not-for-profits or for-profits in some cases. We're making staffing adjustments. You know, our Office of Housing is not just about making sure that a young working family has the opportunity to buy a first home. That housing office is also engaged in making sure that your home is not a gutter, right? So we're doing more soup to nuts stuff. That happens certainly within our organization and our partner organizations. The City County Health Department has had to change the way it does business. We participate along with many partners in the Partnership Health Center. So we've had to make lots of those adjustments. And while in a world where I had more control, we wouldn't be having a conversation about a warming shelter, because folks' mental illness would be treated, their addiction would be treated, their poverty would be eliminated, their bellies would be filled, and they would be able to participate fully in their communities.
Right.
But barring all of that, we're going to do triage until it gets better.
You know what? One thing I want to ask you quickly about, one of the things that we talked about at our last meeting was all the development that's going on in town, and that's just something that you're quite proud of.
I am.
And looking forward to 2019, what does it look like there in terms of new companies coming into town? You have a new head of the MEP. You have that are going to attract new businesses. You talked a little bit about housing in town and how to accommodate for the increased workforce that's, you know, starting to work in the downtown area. So if you could just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I think 2019 is pretty exciting on a lot of fronts.
It's always good talking with you, catching up. And in a few months, as we move into 2019, we hope we can come back and talk to you more about the things that are important for Missoulians to know.
Would love that. It's always a pleasure talking with you, gentlemen.
You too. All right, Arnie, I'll see you tomorrow. Oh, no, I won't see you. I'll see you next year.
See you next year.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you to Director of Communications Ginny Miriam and Mayor John Engen for today's interview. Arnie and I were pleased to speak with Mayor Engen and talk about a review of the year 2018, as well as what to look forward to in 2019. This marks our last show of the year, and Arnie and I look forward to joining you again in 2019 right here on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. Have a happy holiday and a great new year.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.